You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll take a scientific look at the best ways to cook different kinds of meat.
First, for fans of Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House books, there's a real sense of the family living both in harmony with the land and struggling against the challenges it presented them.
The series starts with the little house in the Big Wood, which is near Lake Pepin in Wisconsin.
In a new book, Marta McDowell traces the Ingalls' life in Wisconsin and beyond and how they related to the specific landscapes from which they worked to earn a living. Her book is The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the frontier landscapes that inspired the Little House books. Marta, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith. Glad to be here.
You clearly have a connection to gardening and the landscape, but what's your connection to Laura Ingalls Wilder?
Oh, well, you know, I always loved Laura Ingalls Wilder. I loved the books. I guess I kind of missed the TV shows, but that was just because I was in college at the time. But I found that there were a lot of connections as I reread the book, so that was really fun.
And Laura's story starts here in Wisconsin in the little house in the Big Woods. But, and I didn't realize this until reading your book, Charles and Caroline's story started earlier in Wisconsin. Tell us about her parents' life first.
Yes, well, you know, her mother was actually born in Brookfield, Wisconsin. And her father was born in New York State, but then came with his family across the upper Midwest, which was really common at the time, and then eventually settled in Concord. And I guess by that time, Caroline and her family had moved to Concord as well. And so that's where they met, and that's where they first farmed.
And tell us about that area. What kind of a landscape were they dealing with as they tried to farm there?
Well, you know, Wisconsin, much of it was wooded. And, you know, as the settlers came across, they were taking out the woods to make it into agricultural land. So, you know, I'm not sure about that exact area around Concord. I'm actually heading out there to visit Old World, Wisconsin, and visit both where Caroline was born and where Charles and Caroline had their first house, because that's an area I hadn't been to yet.
And so what led them, Charles and Caroline, from the southeast corner of the state to the northwest area?
Well, they were following family. His family had moved up to that area near Lake Pepin. And so, and his brother had as well, I think actually quite a bit of his family. So they followed, just often as families do. You know, they decided to try a new place. It was kind of... You know, for Charles, it was a continuation of his life as a mover, right? He was sort of a rolling stone. And for Caroline, I guess it was, you know, early. You know, it was, she wasn't like that growing up as much. So I think that was just the beginning of their sort of odyssey, if you will.
And let's talk about that landscape around Pepin, Wisconsin, and Lake Pepin, which, as you note, is actually not a true lake. It's actually a widening of the Mississippi River. And that's where Ma and Pa Ingalls moved and raised their family, of course, including Laura. Describe that area for us.
So it was very wooded. The Wisconsin woods were considered a great natural wonder. And, you know, parts of Wisconsin, they still are. But if you think about the late 19th century, by that time, the East Coast had been pretty much timbered out for anything that was accessible because, you know, wood was so important for any building materials, for transportation, for fuel. So that was viewed as, you know, this wonderful thing. And so there was a huge timber boom in Wisconsin at the time. But also, and this surprised me, Wisconsin, after the Civil War, was producing 1/6 of the nation's wheat crop. Hmm. So it was a huge wheat producer. Another thing that surprised me as I went along was that on their first farm in Concord, Caroline and Charles grew hops.
For the beer industry, I'm guessing.
For the beer industry. So I don't know why that would have surprised me, but it hadn't appeared in any of the Little House books. Laura has one mention of a brewery in Pioneer Girl, her autobiography. Mm-hmm. But that brewery is actually in New Ulm, Minnesota. So they were already, you know, heading out on the wagon train. So I guess by the time she was old enough to remember, they had probably finished with hops. But I found that in a letter that the Wisconsin Historical Society had.
Let's talk more about those trees and the woods. The trees around where Laura and her family were living, there was a huge variety of trees. What were some of the trees that she would have been very familiar with?
So I guess the most prominent tree that's talked about in Little House in the Big Woods are the oaks. And Wilder really takes pains to describe these two big oaks that were in front of their log cabin. And she was one of two little girls in the family at the time. It was Laura and her older sister, Mary. And they each sort of claimed an oak tree. You know, you can imagine as two kids in a family would. You know, one was Laura's oak tree and one was Mary's oak tree. And they were, you know, sort of one of their designated play spots. And she mentions, you know, playing with the acorns. Oh, we always did that when we were kids. Mm-hmm. Did you?
Yes, yes. even as a Chicago girl, I did.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember just in our little suburban backyard, in the fall, I would take a rake and I would rake leaves into like a floor plan. I don't know if that was like a little hint that I was going to be a garden designer, but I would rake like little, like with the walls and doors, and I'd make a little sort of house on the lawn.
Marta McDowell is the author of The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House books. And the woods were different just a little further north, where it transitions into more the pines and the conifers. But they were really in a different kind of woods than maybe some people who don't know the area around Pepin, Wisconsin would imagine.
Yeah, so they were in a kind of mixed hardwood forest. You know, there were oaks, there were walnuts, and the book, even though it was a children's book, it mentions a lot of very specific plant life. So, of course, if I'm sort of a plant nerd, I found that really, you know, exciting. But then a little further north, when it gets into the real big woods, and she talks about going up to Grandpa Ingalls, and they're going up to maple sugaring, and there's a really big deal. There was an actual transition zone, you know, so today we would probably call it a different biome, right? And you get up into where there really were more maples. So this little childhood memory, you know, you can draw a line to actual ecology today. And it was really fun. I found in Madison, as a matter of fact, in the university collections, there was an old 19th century map of the native vegetation of Wisconsin from 1882, and this really interesting colored map that showed the different zones of the, you know, where were the grasslands and where were the different forest zones. And I could pinpoint where the farm was and, you know, where her grandfather's farm was and really see. It's like, oh, this wasn't just a fictional, you know, we're going to make up this fantasy woodland. This was actually true. And so, you know, you go Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Marta McDowell is the author of The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House books. She's with us to examine the different landscapes that the Ingalls family called home.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Marta McDowell. She's the author of The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House books.
And Marta, when I was reading your book, I was struck by two competing themes, fighting against nature and also relying on nature. Is that something you thought about as you wrote the book?
Yeah, you know, it's so we're looking at this with our eyes from 2017, right? And so now we might say, oh, well, you know, they cut down so much forest and change the land so much, was that really the right thing to do, right? Because we're looking at it with 21st century eyes. They were, sort of creating a farmland, a sustainable lifestyle, you know, for their families. And so, you know, they were doing a little bit of both. So here's Charles Ingalls and his brother, and they're carving out this opening in the Wisconsin woods. And so throughout Little House in the Big Woods, they're talking about, you know, cutting down trees, fighting against the trees coming back. The kids are always playing on stumps, right? So it wasn't like, oh, they clear the whole space. They just basically cut down the trees and plant around it. And yet, Charles Ingalls loved the woods. He loved to hunt. He was kind of also really tender-hearted about the woods and the animals that lived there. Was careful not to take the deer at the wrong time of year, you know, when they were nurturing their young. So he had that, you know, what I feel is the real hunter's love of nature. And so it was both sides of the coin. And I could see it from their point of view.
And what about Caroline? What was she able to glean from that natural landscape to either help feed or clothe or keep her family healthy?
Yeah, so all through the Little House books, there are mentions of wild plants being used, right? So they're collecting nuts. There's smoking fish. They're using the wood for tools. There are mentions of medicinal plants, not too many specifics, but, you know, of sort of making poultices and teas and things like that. And, you know, they really were out in the wilderness, so they weren't, they didn't have an easy access to doctors, that's for sure.
And one of the things that you noted and made me chuckle, because I just recently realized that that's what's growing uninvited, let's say, in my own backyard, is pokeberry. And it has these berries that they used as a dye.
Yeah. So there's a famous scene in Little House in the Big Woods where Laura gets a doll, a real doll named Charlotte. And the doll's handmade, and the doll's, you know, facial features have been drawn in with pokeberry ink. And my antenna went up, because pokeberry grows all around me in New Jersey. It grew all around my father's farm in Kentucky. And in the spring, my father would harvest it, and you know, it has to be properly prepared. It's one of these things that has a lot of oxalic acid in it. But he and my mother would eat the greens. I think they changed the water 3 times, something like that. And I don't remember eating it because I was a kid and I just turned up my nose. But it's like, oh, poke. I know pokeweed. I think it would be a fabulous ornamental for crazy gardeners like me. The problem is, you know, if it sows around in your garden, it's got a taproot that goes down, like way down. And so you don't really want it in your garden. And yet it is a native plant, right? It is a pollinator. You know, some pollinators do use it as a host plant. So it is really a good thing. But if you let it go, it would take over your whole backyard.
So we've talked about some of the elements in their natural surroundings that the Ingalls were able to use themselves. Were there things that they were also able to sell as a profit, to buy those things that they couldn't produce themselves?
So Charles was definitely harvesting pelts. He was a good hunter. And again, the books talk about how he made the bullets and goes into a lot of detail. And so he was trading not just on his farm, but probably getting a lot more cash from the furs. And, of course, the fur industry was huge in the upper Midwest as well.
How unique was the Wisconsin landscape for the Ingalls compared to the other places that they then eventually moved to?
So it was, the only place that had really abundant wood, right? The other places, there would have been some wood, but not nearly as much. So Wisconsin was really their forested landscape. And then, I mean, think about all of the other places that they went. So they were in Minnesota, I guess, yeah, along Plum Creek, there would have been some wood, but then there was a lot of grassland. Mm-hmm. Dakota, what's now Kansas, which was then Indian Territory. They lived for a time in Baroque, Iowa. You know, in those places, they would have had some stands of trees, but it wouldn't have been the forest. So it would have been quite different.
And as we wrap up, Marta, how would you describe the Ingalls' relationship to the lands that they inhabited?
Well, one pleasant surprise to me as I went along was I realized that, you know, nowadays we'd call it sustainable agriculture or, you know, the small family farm. And a lot of people are, you know, looking at that as a model, you know, in addition to the beautiful, great big farms that you have as well. But that the Ingalls and then later Laura Ingalls Wilder and her husband really were kind of sustainable farmers. I mean, they amended their soil. Almanzo Wilder, for example, used cover crops, you know, nitrogen-fixing mm-hmm. cover crops. He never let the quails be hunted in his 1,000-tree apple orchard because he said, you know, they eat the bugs, and that's why my trees are much healthier than my neighbor's trees. And Laura Ingalls Wilder, in her journalism, because she wrote a lot of farm journalism, really talks about, you know, the practices of never letting things go to waste, and you save the scraps to go to the chickens. And it resonated for me with writings of people like Aldo Leopold, you know, another one of your famous Wisconsin folks, you know, so much that I actually quoted him. He said, there are two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is the danger of supposing that breakfast comes from the grocery, and the other that heat comes from the furnace.
Hmm.
And I think that Laura Ingalls Wilder lived that, and then she also communicated it to us, right? She passed it down in these very, you know, sort of heartwarming children's books.
Well, Marta, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Judith.
Marta McDowell is the author of The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House Books. She joined us to talk about the Wisconsin landscape that the Ingalls family called home. Have you ever thought much about what scientific processes are happening when you plop a couple of sirloins on the grill? Have you ever wondered why certain cuts of meat taste better than others?
Well, our next guest may have some answers for us. Dr. Stuart Faramond joins us now. He's a food scientist, and his new book is called The Science of Cooking: Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. Dr. Stu, welcome to Central Time.
A pleasure.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into the world of food science?
I have quite a unique story, I would say. I was originally a medical doctor about 10 years ago, and I was diagnosed with a brain tumor at the time, and that forced me to leave medicine. So I then went into, it's a malignant brain tumor, and it was completely removed with the operation. It left me with epilepsy, which meant that I couldn't go back to medicine because there was a danger of me having seizures whilst I was working. So I left the medical profession, went into teaching, and then from teaching went into freelance science writing and science communication, and kind of fell into food research and food science. And so I guess nearly a decade on, I've got around to writing a book.
And your book covers the science of a lot of different kinds of food. We're going to talk about meat in particular today, but talk about just how much science can go into how we cook and how we can make better food.
Oh, it's huge. Absolutely huge, Rob. I think we do cooking a disservice when we just pick up a recipe book and follow it because before our eyes when we're cooking, when we're getting something ready to eat, there's some incredible things going on. And it's not just an academic thing of, oh, isn't it nice to know that there's chemical reactions going on, or why when I beat this egg white, it turns into this kind of this fluffy white meringue thing. But if you understand it, you can actually cook better. And you realize that a lot of things that you read about in the cookery books and you see that TV chefs do aren't actually always that right. So it's a really empowering thing, and it also will give you ideas to be more creative and try new stuff.
You mentioned chemical reactions in cooking, and that takes us to meat and this thing. I've heard of it before. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. The Maillard reaction.
Yeah, you can say it however you want to say it.
How should I say it? Oh.
Tomato, tomato. I'm not Maillard reaction. M-A-L-L. M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D, Maillard reaction. It's the thing that gives meat its flavor. It's also called the browning reaction, although if you just call it the browning reaction, it does it a disservice, because it's not just about turning something brown. It's about giving flavor. If you cook something, when you cook meat, say you put it on a grill or something, and it gets that brown kind of crust going on, that's the Maillard reaction taking place. And it happens between about 218 and 320 degrees Fahrenheit. And what's happening is the proteins that are in the meat itself, they're breaking down, and they're reacting with sugars. There's molecules of sugar within every single cell, and they react. And these two things, which are quite tasteless, come together to react to these countless different ways, and you get all these flavors come out. You get meaty, kind of caramelly flavors, nutty flavors. The reason why caramel tastes like caramel is because of the Maillard reaction. You need to harness the Maillard reaction if you want your meat to taste like meat.
And we don't want to undercook meat, because that's hazardous. We hit that sweet spot with the Maillard reaction. My curse is the overcooking of meat. What happens to that delicious flavor when we let it cook too hot or too long?
Well, you can obviously have a steak that's rare in the middle. The main thing is that you get the outside seared, so that you get that meatiness on the outside. And if you like, if you've got a tender cut of meat and you want it to be served rare or medium rare, then that's okay, because you're getting that very smooth texture on the inside. So you definitely want the outside seared. But when you're overcooking it, the thing you've got to bear in mind is that the meat, and most of it, the cuts that we buy is muscle. But that is 75 to 85% water. So it's really, it's essentially a big bag of water that's just kind of held together. And so when you're cooking, you want to preserve as much of that moisture as possible. But obviously, the longer you cook it, the more of that moisture that you lose. And even if you cook it in water, then it will still dry out, because what's happening is muscle is made up of millions and millions of hair thickness strands of these muscle fibers. They're individual cells, and they've got water in them. But as you cook it, they shrivel up, and that water gets kind of squeezed out, a bit like if you've got a sponge and it's got water in it, and you squeeze it, and all the water comes out. So when you overcook it, you've essentially caused it to shrivel up, all those cells to kind of shrivel up together. All the moisture comes out, and you end up with this kind of bland, tasteless hunk of leather left over.
And Dr. Stu, you write about how to recover that hunk of leather. Is there anything we could do to save that overcooked meat?
Well, it's a bit like if you've added too much salt to a dish. You can't really undo it, but you can do things to kind of make the best of a bad situation. So the one time when we do overcook meat is when we're doing slow cooking, if we're doing stews or casseroles. And we do that with the chewy cuts of meat, kind of like your chuck and your things like that. And that's because they've got lots of a thing called connective tissue in. Meat itself, you've got the muscle, you've got the fat, and then you've got this thing called connective tissue, which is the white stringy stuff that you get going through it. And that's really difficult to chew. It's really difficult to digest. But if you cook meat slowly, then that connective tissue breaks down into a thing called gelatin, which is the same thing that makes jello wobbly and set. And that gives slow cooked meat this kind of this unctuous, velvety kind of mouthfeel. And so what you want to do is, if you've got a lean cut of meat and you've overcooked it and it's gone dry, if it's turkey or chicken or whatever it is, then you want to try and recreate that kind of that luscious gelatin flavor. And so one way to do it is to shred up your meat and put it into a rich gravy, a rich sauce. If you make it into like a fritter, for example, then you get lots of flavorful things in there, lots of fats and oils in there. You can restore some of that smooth mouthfeel. So you want to get the dryness, split it up, shred it up, maybe put it into meatballs or something, so that you're kind of restoring some of this natural kind of the moisture that was there originally.
Talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond, his new book is The Science of Cooking. We're focusing on meat today. Let's talk marinades now. I've been getting into marinades for chicken and pork chops and things like that. And I keep shooting for as long as I possibly can. I feel bad if I only marinate for half an hour. I'm an idiot. I don't need to marinate it that long, it sounds like, reading your book.
No, Rob, you're doing the right thing. The time-shy person is coming up with the best marinades. the word marinade, that originally just meant like a salty soup that you used to preserve meat in. And somehow over the years, it's got turned into this thing that we put on meat and we leave it for a long time, and somehow the flavors infuse all the way through it. But it doesn't actually happen. If you can do experiments, you can get meat and you can submerge it in something. And the liquid, the flavor-filled liquid that you're putting it in, what's your favorite marinade, Rob?
I've come up with this chicken shawarma marinade. I grind cumin and things like that. I'm talking about it all the time. I love this. And it comes out good when I marinate it.
Well, essentially, when you marinate, you're putting a glaze on the outside of the meat, because that marinade can't get very far into the muscle. As I said, muscle is the meat is 75% to 85% water. So it's like a filled sponge. You can't actually get much more in there. So when you're soaking it in this marinade, it's only going in a few millimeters. So you can leave it in your marinade, leave it overnight, leave it 2 days. It's still never going to get right into the middle. And the danger of leaving it more than a few hours is that the acids that are in your marinade, if you've kind of used some vinegar or some lemon juice or some wine or something like that, they're actually starting to break down the surface meat. So it's going to make it kind of go mealy. It's the same thing that if you ever cook fish ceviche, when you get fish and you slice it up really, raw fish, slice it up really fine, and you put it in some lemon juice, and it actually comes out kind of cooked tasting. That's because acids will cook meat in the same way it does if we were to heat it.
And I wanted to ask you right about a question that I think everybody has. Why do so many things taste like chicken?
Well, there's kind of two reasons behind this. One is the type of muscle that you got with chicken. Normally with chicken, we're thinking of the chicken breast, which is this pale muscle. And that has got, it's called a fast twitch muscle, in that it's designed for doing short bursts of activity. So it's the breast muscle. So normally a chicken would be using it to flap its wings. And that kind of muscle doesn't have much red coloring, doesn't have much of a thing called myoglobin, which is what makes meat red. So it doesn't have much flavor from that point of view. It doesn't have much of the flavor carrying fat. And so essentially, it's quite a bland muscle. Essentially, it's bland. So other bland-tasting meats that are like that, like frog, for example, or pigeon or something like that, it'll taste quite similar because there's not much to distinguish it from other muscles. Whereas, say, beef and lamb, they're a different kind of muscle. They're these endurance muscles, and they have a lot more flavor and a lot more character than. Interestingly, scientists have tracked back using genetics to try and work out where the different animals came from. And it seems that most of the animals that we eat came from a now extinct ancestor, which tasted a lot like chicken. So dinosaurs tasted like chicken.
Wow. Like, that makes you think. If only we could try them. We're talking about the science of cooking meat with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of the book, The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking.
And you can join the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you ever wonder what's going on scientifically when you cook your food? What's your go-to cut of meat? What have you learned about cooking meat through trial and error? You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking.
And you can share your food science-related questions or comments or answers with us by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. What have been your biggest successes and failures cooking meat? Do you have a foolproof technique that you want to share? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Philip on the line in Stevens Point. Philip, hi.
Hi. My question is about intentionally aging meat, sometimes to the point where it looks like it may be rotten. I've heard it increases the flavor. It's a desirable thing.
Philip, thanks. Dr. Stu, aging meat?
Well worth doing, really well worth doing. And yes, it will go brown on the outside, and yes, you will get some mold in it quite possibly. But it's something that's doing something that's well worth doing if you want to get flavor out of your meat. Because what's happening is when you age meat, you're letting enzymes within the meat itself do some of the digesting for you. It will be breaking down the muscle and making it more tender. You can kind of think of it that the muscle, when it's alive, it's doing a lot of stuff. It's going through a lot of stress, and it's having to repair itself the whole time. And a part of that repairing process is that there are enzymes in the muscle that break it down so that it can be rebuilt again. But when the animal is dead, they obviously can't be rebuilt. But those enzymes that do the breaking down are still in there. So if you let the meat rest, those enzymes will do some of the breaking down. And after about 14 days, it will be at 80% maximum tenderness. So that's a really good time to leave it for. If you can leave it for longer, that's even better. The trick is to make sure you've got a big bit of meat because it's going to dry out. Put it in the fridge. Make sure put a drip tray underneath it and put some water in that drip tray. And essentially just leave it in there. The water in the drip tray, some of that will evaporate and that will increase the humidity within your fridge. And so that will stop it drying out a bit. And so go back periodically and check on it. And if there's kind of there's crusts and there's bits of mold on the outside, that's okay. That's normal. When you come to finish, you just want to chop that off. And then the meat inside, it'll still be red inside. It'll be brown on the outside, but it'll be red on the inside. And you have really tender, really beautiful meat on the inside.
I don't know, man. I'm getting a little nervous about meat in my fridge after day 4, maybe. How do I know for sure that this meat is just aged and not, you know, hitting rancid / lethal stage?
I would say get your meat from a good quality butcher so that you know the meat's been handled well, and so you're not going to have lots of nasty pathogens on the outside if it's been kind of thrown around some kind of packaging plant before it was slapped in some cellophane. But it's that's good so that you're not going to have super nasties on the outside. But essentially, if you've got good quality meat and you put it in your fridge, it should be fine. All right. If you've got any questions, find a friendly butcher and ask them about how they age their meat. They're great people to talk to for finding out tips on aging meat. But give it a go. Give it a go. Make sure you've got a big bit. Don't do it with a steak or something because it will shrivel up and the moldy bits will end up being more than the meat that's left over and you'll be really disappointed. So get a big bit of meat. Don't be worrying about that you're going to have to shear off some of the outside because what's left on the inside will be really good.
Philip, thanks. Hope that helps you out. We'll go next to Daryl on the line in Hayward. Daryl, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
My question is regarding steak tartare. I'd like him to comment on that because that's raw ground sirloin on dark rye bread. What does he have to say about that?
Daryl, thanks. This is big in certain subcultures in Wisconsin, Dr. Stu. Steak tartare, what do you think?
Hey, Daryl. Yeah, Daryl, I love steak tartare. It's really nice. If you're kind of worried from a sort of a health and safety point of view,
and
then
I am.
Steak is... Then you are. Are you worried, Rob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's safe. It's fine. It is fine. The thing that, I mean, we know, we're told that raw meat is dangerous. But the thing is that the inside of the meat is fine. It's only the outside of the meat that's been exposed to the air and that's got all the bugs on it that is the dangerous bit. When you get to the inside of the meat, that's going to be essentially perfectly sterile. So providing you're not, so if you're using the middle of the meat and you're eating it raw, then it should be absolutely fine. You should always use your senses. So if, our senses are highly attuned, highly evolved to be able to pick up when something isn't right. If it tastes bitter, then that means that there's something in there. There's maybe some toxins or something in there that bugs happen to have been crawling on it. Don't eat it if it's sticky or slimy or if it doesn't smell good. But if it's, if none of those things, it should be perfectly fine.
Daryl, thanks a lot. Talk about the science of cooking with meat. And we're talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. His new book is called The Science of Cooking. He covers a lot of kinds of cooking. We're focusing on the meat chapter today. You also write about different kinds of chicken. And when you're at the store, you might see all kinds of different labels on chicken: organic, free range, indoor, outdoor. Does it matter what we buy in terms of what it's going to taste like?
One thing I must say about the raw meat thing is that whereas steaks can be served rare, if your hamburgers are less safe because hamburgers are made from mince, and so that mince has all been exposed to the air, and so when you're pounding all together, you've essentially got potentially all the outside bits of meat all mushed up on the inside. So you've got to be more cautious with hamburgers. But essentially, what I said before holds true. Chicken. Yes, they'll try and sell as anything, won't they? Happy chicken, corn-fed chicken. If you can taste the difference, you're doing well. I'll be honest with you, because I've tried very expensive chicken and cheap chicken, and it's hard to tell the difference apart. But there are differences. There are subtle differences. One thing to bear in mind is that the chickens that we'll eat from today, they're broiler chickens. They're kind of a hybrid bird that has never existed in the wild. And we've bred them so that they're bigger and bigger and bigger. And they produce loads of meat, but it's quite tasteless. The only way if you're going to have really flavorful chicken is to actually go to a heritage breed chicken, one that is actually smaller. They have to live longer before they're killed because they're slower growing. 50 years ago, the chickens that we were eating then were a quarter of the size of the chickens that we have now. That's how far it's gone. So I would say the breed of the chicken is probably going to be the biggest influence on the flavor that you're going to have from the chicken. But it's quite hard to get hold of a heritage breed chicken, and it's going to cost you a small fortune if you do find it. So short of that, you want to go for the best living conditions possible for your chicken. So stuff that is organic, that's the best marker that you've probably got if you've gone down the supermarket to know whether the chicken has had a good life or not. Because any animal that is stressed or has had a poor life, the meat will be inferior. Organic means that it's had more area to live in. It has access to the outside. They should be down to about 5 chickens per square meter. Whereas if you go for your indoor farmed chicken, which will just be everything that doesn't say otherwise on the packet, then they will put up to 20 chickens in a square meter. That's how they live. It's quite... you just have to go onto YouTube and look at the videos to see how unpleasant it is. So I would say go for the best welfare possible. You'll see also corn-fed chicken. Now, that just means that they've been fed corn and they'll have a slightly different flavor and the color of the meat will be slightly more yellow. But it doesn't mean anything about how well it's been kept. So corn-fed could mean that it's been reared in inhumane conditions, but it's just been fed corn. So I would go for welfare secondary to going for a heritage breed if you can get hold of one.
Well, Dr. Stu, we've just scratched the surface. I hope we can talk to you again before too long. Thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure, Rob.
That was Dr. Stuart Faramond, food scientist and author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. And we've been talking about the science of cooking meat. wine has been around for a long time. Until recently, the thought was that people have been enjoying wine for about 7,000 years.
One of the places where evidence of winemaking goes back a long time is Georgia, the country in the Caucasus region, not the U.S. state.
Georgians were thought to be making wine for about 6,000 years, but until recently, the oldest evidence had been found in northwestern Iran.
But, drumroll please, the Georgians have taken the lead. Scientists have found 8,000-year-old pottery fragments south of the capital Tbilisi, which chemical tests show as having wine residue on them.
They also had images of grape clusters and a man dancing, which, you know, are pretty convincing evidence, too.
So, cheers to the Georgians for bringing us the enjoyment of wine 8 millennia ago. We raise our glasses to you here on Central Time.
We've talked to Gemma Tarlak about similar issues before, and I'm always curious, what does that 8,000-year-old wine taste? I mean, not wine that's been sitting for 8,000, but if you could recreate the recipe.
That'd be awesome.
What would it taste like?
Yeah. Would it be good? And would we like it?
Do we need a budget for a time machine here at Central Time?
Or really good winemaking materials. One of the two.
I think I say both. Cover all our bases. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.